The hour of 2:45 having arrived and gone, I'll call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. The first bill on the agenda is Representative Eakin's bill, House File 3640. Representative Eakin, you ready to go?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I have also a delete all amendment, the DE1 amendment, if you could have that moved.
Representative Eakin, I would move, first of all, that House File 3640 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. And then, Representative Eakin, I will move adoption of the DE1 amendment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And
since that is a delete all, do we have a quorum? No? We do have a quorum present, so I'll move adoption of the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Eakin, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill gives the ability of a utility to seek advance determination of prudence from the Public Utilities Commission for projects that are undertaken to comply with federal or state air quality standards. And the PUC would be required under this to rule on such a petition that a public utility would make within 10 months as to whether it qualifies for advanced determination. The reason this is being done is to give some certainty for the public utilities when they go to get loans in order to implement the projects and the technology that's necessary to comply with the environmental regulations. And the credit markets right now are very tight. It's one of the reasons that it's needed. There is a need for the upfront regulatory permissions to pursue these environmental upgrades and, again, provide some certainty so that they can acquire the capital necessary to do so. It'll allow utilities to acquire capital at more favorable terms and ultimately helps the customer rates as well. So with that, I think I'll just turn it over to, I have Mr. Lauren Logtug here with Otter Tail Power, who's going to speak to the bill as well or answer any questions that members may have.
Thank you. Mr. Logtug, before you begin with your testimony, I would mention to members that we do have a long agenda today, being that we were unable to meet on Monday, thanks to the longevity of the floor session. If we do not get through the agenda today, we will be convening on Friday at 10:30 a.m. to finish the agenda. So I hope that we can deal with these bills expeditiously and avoid that, but if we can't, we can't. Mr. Logtug, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lauren Logtug. I represent Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as you may recall, in 2005, Otter Tail and six other partners announced that they were going to pursue what was called the Big Stone 2 coal plant project in South Dakota. And over the course of time till January of 2009, we pursued a certificate of need for a transmission upgrade from the Big Stone site to substations in Montevideo and Morris, Minnesota. In September of 2009, my company concluded that it was not going to be possible to pursue and complete the Big Stone 2 project for our company. And so in September of 2009, Otter Tail withdrew from that project. The remaining partners sought someone to take our place, and in November of 2009, they concluded that they were not finding a partner, and so they brought a close to the Big Stone 2 project. Now, You may recall that the Big Stone 2 project was designed to accomplish a number of things. One of those was that we were going to clean up the emissions from the existing Big Stone plant at the Big Stone site. And for your information, the Big Stone plant is a 457 megawatt coal plant built in 1975. Since November of 2009, when the project was brought to a close, Otter Tail and its partners in the existing Big Stone plant have been working hard to come up with a plan B for cleaning up the emissions from Big Stone plant. And we're responding to requirements to comply with what's known as EPA's regional haze reduction requirements, otherwise known under the title of Best Available Retrofit Technology, or BART. Our cleanup plan was submitted to the South Dakota DENR in November of 2009. The South Dakota DENR is evaluating that. They are going to come up with what's called a SIP, or a State Implementation Plan, and they will submit their State Implementation Plan to EPA Region 8 in Denver. Once EPA has that plan, they will then rule on the plan as being possible or not permitted, either permitted or not permitted. Once permitting is complete, we have to begin with our partners to do design and preparation for construction. And also, we have to undertake efforts to make sure that we can recover costs for investments in a project of this magnitude. In the Dakotas, utilities have riders for any environmental upgrades that are done in response to federal mandates or requirements. And so we know going in that if we do a project that's in response to the Clean Air Act, that we'll get cost recovery in South Dakota and North Dakota. In Minnesota, on the other hand, there's no clear path for determining whether it's prudent to clean up a coal plant, or on the other hand, or following from that, there's no clear path to cost recovery. Prudence is necessary for determining whether you'll get cost recovery or not. By way of reminder, Minnesota has what's known as the MERP statute for cleaning up emissions in Minnesota, the Minnesota Emissions Reduction Program. The MERP statute provides for a rider recovery, but it only applies to projects that are considered to be voluntary. It also only applies to projects that are in the state of Minnesota. As Representative Eakin just pointed out, projects that lack certainty and lack cost recovery are difficult to manage and difficult to finance. So we have a project that's out of state, and we have a need to refurbish our plant to comply with the Clean Air Act. We have no clear path at this time to determining prudence, and thus we have no clear path to cost recovery. The project I'm describing to you is on the order of $200 to $300 million. It takes 4 to 5 years to complete permitting and construction. Since we own approximately 54% of the Big Stone plant, and since approximately 52% of our customers are in Minnesota, the rough cost for our Minnesota customers would be $70 million. So, before we embark on a project to retrofit or upgrade a 1975-era coal plant and modernize its environmental controls, we would like the opportunity to ask our state regulators, is this the prudent thing to do? And we believe House File 3640 provides for the opportunity to do this with what's being called an advanced determination of prudence at the Public Utility Commission. In Minnesota, if you want to build a new coal plant, you need what's known as a certificate of need. And so you go to the commission and ask, is this the right thing to do? If you want to build a new transmission line, you need a certificate of need. And so you go to the commission and you say, is this the prudent thing to do? But if you have to do major environmental upgrades, there's no clear path to how do you get permission from the commission and the Office of Energy Security and the PCA to pursue this. So, with no presumption of prudence, there's also no presumption of cost recovery. And without presumption of cost recovery, it's very difficult to deal with lenders and even with shareholders. So the options that we'll lay out as alternatives when we go to the commission are pretty straightforward. Do we refurbish this plant as we've agreed to with EPA and with South Dakota DENR? Or do we repower the plant with a different fuel? Or finally, do we replace the plant with something brand new like a natural gas plant? The uncertainty of these questions leads to concerns among the folks in the lending community. It increases risk, and when you have more risk, you have higher borrowing costs. The advanced determination of prudence that's in this bill, House File 3640, we believe provides us for the opportunity to get permission from the commission to proceed with whatever alternative they deem is best. This means that we could potentially lower our interest rates or borrowing costs with bankers, and when you can lower your interest rates and borrowing costs, you can also keep your rates as low as possible for customers. In developing the bill, we have had good discussions with the Minnesota PUC, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Chamber, and with Bill Grant from the Isaac Walton League. That's not meant to mean that any of them have endorsed our bill at this point, but I'm just letting you know that we've had discussions with all of those parties and done our very best to try to accommodate the concerns of everyone. One last thing I'll mention is that in Subdivision 5, there's a whole subdivision on cost recovery and cost scrutiny by the Public Utilities Commission. And for their benefit, I need to tell you that there's nothing in Subdivision 5 that we should mean to construe that the bill is attempting to either detract from or add to the PUC's current cost scrutinization authority that's outlined in 216B.16 Subdivision 6A. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have some other experts here. We'll not bring them to testify, but they're certainly here. I have counsel here to answer questions on whatever issues you might have. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Logtug or for the author? Representative Kalin?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the note of caution from Mr. Logtug on Subdivision 5, the cost recovery piece. I think maybe just to make a comment, and if you need to respond, you know, I have concerns about the related to the sort of precipitated the Rider study and cost recovery in general, sort of pre-scrutinizing before it goes in a rate case, and if you could just maybe make a commitment to continue to work with me and others as we try to not only bring the Rider study to fruition, but also to make sure that we're kind of modernizing our rate structure as it is. This gives me a little bit of pause. I'm willing to go forward because you and I have had initial discussions about the dilemma that you do face, and I'm empathetic, but hope that we can nip these in the bud for the long haul.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Logtug.
Representative Kalin, I want to tell you we are involved in that process. In fact, I think the report is due from the commission on June 30th, and we did submit written comments to the commission on the subject of riders. We considered requesting a rider when we first began discussions about this, but decided because the legislature has decided to review the whole rider concept and what it does, what it means, what it provides, that this would not be the appropriate time to ask for a rider for this.
Appreciate that.
Representative Westrom?
Chair, Mr. Watchog, is this on? It doesn't hardly sound like it, but I'll talk to you anyway. Can you refresh the committee's memory of the cost of Bigstone 2? And as I recall, this one's better. Can you refresh the committee's memory on the cost of Bigstone 2? And as I recall, this cleanup project was part of that going forward. Is the cost of this likely to be no more than it would have been as a part of that project, or has the cost gone up some because that project isn't occurring, and if so, what's the cost difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, the projected cost of the Bigstone 2 plant with its transmission upgrades, as best I recall, was about $1.5 billion. We project this to cost somewhere in the range of $200 to $300 million. It's very likely that that cost is higher than it would have been if we had done the Big Stone 2 project, because of the synergies available when you're doing two projects at the same time. It's a precise number. I can't give you a precise number.
Thanks. Further questions for the witness or the author? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? I know we have some names on the agenda, but I understand they're just here to answer questions or support the bill.
Chairman.
Mr. Grant, if you're going to speak in support of the bill, I would request that you follow the Van der Rohe principle.
Mr. Chairman, I'm actually not speaking in support of the bill, even though we've...
All right.
I'm Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League. We've worked closely with Ottertail Power and appreciate the changes that have been made to the bill, principally in Subdivision 2 of the bill that adds reporting requirements that will help us assess the issues that Mr. Lautog was suggesting that we consider before we make investments in older coal-fired power plants, and those are on lines 121 through all the way through the next page on 2.10, and I appreciate that. However, I still believe that this is an answer in search of a problem. To my knowledge, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission has never denied cost recovery for a federally mandated pollution control equipment investment, and I'm concerned that granting pre-prudence approval gives a presumption in favor of making that investment, even after we do the assessments that have since been added to the original bill. So my concern is that the bill as it stands, even though it has been improved, still creates a presumption in favor of making what might turn out to be unwise investments on behalf of ratepayers. Be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Grant? Mr. Grant, I believe I recall in other bills and other legal documents a specific disclaimer about a presumption of anything. Do you think that that would satisfy your concern in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, it would certainly help.
Further questions for Mr. Grant or Representative Eakin? Seeing none, thank you. The chair will renew his motion that House File 3640, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seifert, House File 3582. Members, while Representative Seifert is preparing to present his bill, there's a matter that I would like to clear up, which is that in the last meeting of this committee, we heard from the Republican lead on the committee that there was an allegation that the bill and the finance bill that was presented at that time had only been presented to minority members of the committee the evening before the hearing. members, I have, and seem to have misplaced at the moment, copies of emails sent beginning on February 25th, Representative Westrum, to both your committee, your legislative assistant, and also to Mr. Marble, inviting you to meet with me to discuss the finance bill. That was followed up on March 1st with another email, from which again we got no response. And finally, a third time on March 3rd, that was sent not only to your legislative assistant and Mr. Marble, but to you personally. And we never did get a response to any of those requests for a meeting. I just want to have that in the record, since you felt it necessary to put in the record that you had not seen this bill, or the finance bill, before it was rolled out. I want to make it clear that you did have the opportunity, and it's really up to you whether you took it or not.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Westman.
Mr. Chairman, feel free next time to use the telephone if you want, and I think it still stands as the record that it was the night before we received the DFL proposed cuts. That was my allegation. It wasn't that we didn't have the time to discuss it before. It was that we had received your proposals, final proposals, the night before. That's what I said. If that wasn't unclear, that's what I meant.
And Representative Westrum, you could check with your legislative assistant and find that I personally came down to try to catch you to discuss this, since we hadn't had any response. I guess next time we'll have to try harder. Representative Seifert, House File 3582.
Mr. Chair, I'd move
what
that
are we trying to fix here, Representative Seifert?
Mr. Chair, I'd move that House File 3582 be recommended to pass, and we have to go to finance.
Representative Seifert, because the bill did not meet the first deadline in the Senate, it's going to have to go to rules first.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll make that motion, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 3582 is in response to concerns I have gotten from people throughout Minnesota, frankly, especially in the business community, concerned about the mandates that have been put forth in the legislature relating to forcing renewable energy standards that they feel may be unrealistic in increasing the price of electricity. Mr. Chairman, members, one of the advantages Minnesota has over other states when it comes to being competitive, and we don't have any advantages when it comes to taxes or regulations, but one thing that we do have an advantage of is our electricity tends to be more affordable than the electricity rates in places like California or New York or Florida. The concern I have had, Mr. Chair, and many others, particularly in the consumer community, I will call it, is that the mandates will end up driving up the cost of generation of electricity to the point where we'll become uncompetitive and it'll be passed on to the ratepayers. What this bill does is it replaces the mandate with the good faith language that I think takes the heavy hand off of the mandate. I know Mr. Franklin is here from the Minnesota Chamber. I'd like an opportunity to testify on some of the concerns that he's heard. We could certainly can have some discussion on this, Mr. Chair, but I do think we have to take a strong look at how much this is costing ratepayers. Certainly it's laudable at what people's goals are, but there is a cost for everything that we do and everything that we mandate. Once Mr. Franklin is done testifying, I believe there's someone else that wants to testify against the bill, and I think their Representative Beard may have an amendment that he may like to offer on this. But I do think we have to be sensitive, Mr. Chair, to the fact that someone has to pay the bill for all of the great ideas that come out of the legislature, and that they're not free. With that being said, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn over to Mr. Franklin to give his testimony.
Mr. Franklin, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Director of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We represent business energy customers in the state at the Legislature and the Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Chair and members, this bill gives us an opportunity to reflect on the impact of legislation that we passed 3 years ago, and that I'd like to put on the record is the spirit in which I offer the following comments, and that the 2007 law at issue here is very significant, and this is just the best opportunity we've had this session to talk about it. As you know, as I've testified in the past, our standard for Minnesota energy policy is achieving competitive energy costs at the highest possible reliability. And as we said in 2007, the previous policy, the renewable energy objective, or I guess the current policy until 2010, was a strong enough mandate to ensure renewable energy development. That at that time, utilities and renewable energy advocates agreed that renewables can compete on a cost basis with non-renewable sources, and therefore, in our opinion, there was no need for a mandate. And one additional piece that perhaps we didn't realize or know in 2007 but are concerned about now is that customers don't have the tools they need to use the safeguards, pardon me, that the legislature intended when passing the mandate, referring to the off-ramp language. And it's been our experience that there's really no way or no way in the process so far to for customers to judge the relative cost difference between mandate-driven renewables and what the utility might otherwise have done. And I'd just quickly go through those three items. First, it was our belief then and still is now that the REO was a superior policy to increase the amount of renewables while protecting customers. Mandating a good faith effort, as would still remain under Representative Seifert's bill, had been working. Utilities had been adding renewables per their existing mandate. But in our opinion, the REO was a better policy because the state's preference was clearly stated and enforced, and there was no need for an off-ramp, so that it's called, to address any unreasonably high cost, since the mandate was on the utility's effort and not necessarily on the outcome. The new mandate essentially shifted that burden from utilities onto ratepayers, making the number 25% or 30%, depending on the utility, more important necessarily than the impact on customers. And this is troublesome for many reasons, not least being that 25% or 30% might not be the right number for any given utility, let alone all of them. The REO, in our opinion, implicitly took this into account. The burden, as I mentioned, has shifted to customers now to prove that a utility's plans to meet its mandate are not reasonable, instead of proving that the plans are reasonable. In other words, the REO's presumption was in favor of balance and not meeting a legislatively determined percentage. Second, and I'll talk about this because this is sort of new information from 2007, is that customers haven't had the information they need to use the safeguards that the legislature put in place in 2007. In 2007, we believed that the off-ramp, so-called off-ramp language, would be sufficient to ensure that customers could invoke a delay or a modification of the mandate if the cost became unreasonable. And now, in practice, we're not convinced that the off-ramps are sufficient. And you might ask, why is that? We've seen very little analysis done in resource planning as to what a utility might have done absent the mandate. In other words, many of these plans are being filed just presuming that we're going to meet the mandate. And this analysis that I'm referring to is very important because if the analysis isn't performed, a customer group or a customer could never credibly invoke an off-ramp. And we've asked for this information many times in different forms and different utility proceedings and in from the PUC in general. And to date, we have gotten some information, but not in every case. The only two that we're aware of at this point is the Great River Energy Plan in 2008 and Minnesota Power's most recent plan in 2010. Now, let me be clear, we're not arguing that a utility has acted unreasonably thus far, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility that at a certain point the next marginal mandate-driven project might jeopardize a utility customer's competitiveness. and this point may be reached at different times by different utilities. Regardless, customers need the tools to argue that a proposed addition will jeopardize their economic and competitive costs, as the statute contemplates, and that we haven't had those tools to compare a utility's resource additions to what it might have done absent the mandate. In addition to the utility level analysis, we believe in our policy this session suggested that the legislature should order an impact analysis of the RES on Minnesota as a whole, factoring in the net economic development benefits versus the net cost of the mandate as a good sort of cleanup piece. Finally, we recognize that assuming, among other things, that the federal subsidy continues, that wind can compete on a cost basis with other technologies, in particular if there are any costs associated with carbon. Thus far into the mandate, we're satisfied that wind is, in many cases, a competitively priced resource, at least including the PTC, and that any cost increases appear to have been minimal, although the main point is that we can't tell for sure. However, we would ask again, as we did in 2007, what the need is for a specific outcome-driven mandate. If there were no renewable energy mandate, if we were back in sort of REO world and the trend continued that wind was competing on a cost basis, we're confident that utilities would choose wind because A, there would be a good faith effort mandate on them to do so, and B, because the resource would be competitively priced with other possible resources. If that trend were to fail, utilities would be under a mandate to show that they made a best effort attempt at adding wind, but that it couldn't fail, it couldn't pass the cost-benefit test. Indeed, there are other statutory provisions other than the mandate that require a utility to compare new generating resources with renewables and conservation as a condition of PUC approval. And therefore, we would then again ask, why do we need a mandate of 25 or 30% by 2025? This is similar in our case, and I've had a little pushback on this, as you might imagine. We look at this as very consistent with our policy to end Minnesota's nuclear moratorium, because we encourage the legislature to put more options on the table to meet customers' needs, not less. We need all options at our disposal to make sure that Minnesota's electricity remains a competitive advantage of doing business here. Now, in 2007, we supported an expansion of the REO, which ensures Minnesota's environmental goals are met at the lowest possible cost to ratepayers, and we would encourage that today. So thank you for your the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Franklin? Mr. Franklin, is it your feeling then that the existence of the renewable energy standard in Minnesota for the last 2 years has not had any positive economic effect?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I'm able to testify today on the effect of the mandate as a whole. I think we would discriminate between the policy choice of the mandate versus the technology that's been built. And I'm sure that there's been some net economic effect of adding generation. What we're interested in is the net economic effect. What utilities might have done otherwise to meet their customers' needs. And I'm not prepared to answer that question because we don't have that analysis.
Further questions for Mr. Franklin, Representative Kalin?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, to that point, I'm wondering, Mr. Franklin, whether you had done a comprehensive survey of your members and around this question of a really balanced approach about whether there's been positive impacts that they have seen or whether they have been able to, and whether they have been able to really isolate and understand the impact of the renewable electricity standard on their bills, not their rates, but their bills. To what extent does the chamber actually has done that kind of comprehensive work to understand really what's happening with your members and the impact of on their economic situation related specifically to the RES?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I understand the question. I don't believe we've done a comprehensive survey asking for specific members' experience with the RES. What we have done, and what we continue to do every year, is ask about competitive electricity costs, and that brings me to the table here today because we are concerned that Minnesota is losing its advantage or could potentially lose its advantage competitively priced electricity, and more options on the table rather than less would help us with that. But I'm not aware of a specific survey we've done of our members to say, do you understand and appreciate the RES, if I understood your question.
Further questions? Seeing none, Mr. Franklin, thank you.
Thank you.
The other testifier we have on the list is Linda Taylor. Excuse me, I didn't mean to suggest that was the only other testifier. We also have Bill Haney, who we will hear from shortly. Ms. Taylor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Linda Taylor. I'm the Clean Energy Program Director at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is the nonprofit organization in St. Paul who is about to celebrate its 20th year working on energy policy, working towards an efficient economy in the energy sector. We just have some observations, really, about the renewable energy standard itself. We'd like to point out that it's only been in statute for 3 years. It's about to take effect this year. The House bill itself had 35 listed authors. The bill passed the House 123-10. It passed the Senate 61-4. The standards themselves are very similar to those recommended by the Midwestern Governors Association through its Energy Security and Climate Stewardship Roadmap. The roadmap, which was completed in 2009, is based on the MGA's 2007 Energy Security and Climate Accord. The accord itself was initiated by Governor Pawlenty. Just this Tuesday, the National Governors Wind Energy Coalition, 29 governors from all over the country, including Governor Pawlenty, issued a report urging the U.S. Congress to enact a 10% by 2012 renewable electricity standard for the country. This is in line with the standard that will be in effect for Minnesota in 2012, which ranges from 12% to 15%, depending on the utility. Not bad. We're quite a ways ahead of a lot of other states in installing renewable energy. If the entire renewable energy standard is met with wind energy, it would require a total of about 7,000 to 8,500 megawatts of wind development. Of that, we have about 1,800 megawatts installed now. The direct capital investment that would be related to that would be about $10 billion. And that $10 billion gets distributed among a number of counties in Minnesota that have been hard-pressed for economic development for a long time. The $10 billion does not actually include the multipliers, that having jobs with salaries, with people who can buy groceries, et cetera, and taxes and investment income and the like. Unlike most new economic activity in the state, again, this benefit is spread widely, as opposed to building a large central power plant. There are a lot of, when you put up wind turbines, you're putting them up over a fairly dispersed area. And the economic development happens in a lot of different places. The RES is a really good thing for Minnesota. It's good for spreading economic development benefits. It's good for diversification of the electric generation sector in general. It's good for encouraging innovation and technological advances in generation storage and ancillary equipment and services. It's good for reducing our state's over-reliance on coal-fired power plants. It's good for reducing our electricity sector's contribution to pollution, including mercury, sodium dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and carbon emissions. I think the one other thing I would add to my testimony today is we've barely gotten started. We don't know exactly what all of the effects will be of the renewable energy standard. We do know that there is still a requirement that we get the least cost generation into the system. That discipline exists within the regulatory structure. So as we go forward and add renewable electricity to the system, we're still going to be putting that sort of economic discipline and that kind of analysis on each project as it gets built. There are off-ramps. There are exceptions. No one has tried to use those yet. We're probably not far enough along. But if there are legitimate reasons for not being able to meet the standards going forward, there are ways to deal with that. This is not set in stone. So thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.
Questions for Ms. Taylor? Representative Beard.
Ms. Taylor, a few moments ago you referenced 10% of our wind as for part of our ongoing energy needs. And I think I'm remembering a report, Mr. Chairman, the wind integration study we had here several years ago, which seemed to indicate that 10% of our capacity in wind was something that could probably be easily handled by our existing infrastructure and managed at the dispatch center. However, since we've gone to energy policy by bumper sticker slogan, I like to call it 25 by 25 for everybody else, 30 by 20 for the Twin Cities, that number is far beyond the 10% that the wind integration study seemed to indicate we could absorb easily. However, I got a question about the number you're considering. When you talked about the 8,000 megawatts that would help us get there, is that the nameplate capacity of what's hanging up on top of the poles, or is that actually megawatts being put on the bus bar?
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, that would be the nameplate capacity, and the calculations are done basically on a 35% capacity rating for that.
Oh, thank you for clarifying that. I would argue,
Beard.
Mr. Chairman, 35 is probably generous, but for the sake of the argument, we can assume that. That's one more question, if I may. The least cost resource, whenever several of us voted for that bill back in 2007, in fact, there were two of them, Senate File 4, Senate File 145, one of the things we were led to believe after intense negotiations in conference committee with the governor was that we weren't going to wreck the economy, we weren't going to drive up costs and make the business climate more difficult because there were off-ramps and they would continue to insist on the least cost resource for generation. Do you know if the least cost resource when it comes to wind includes the producer payments and the federal tax credits? Are they rolled into that cost as well?
Taylor.
Or is it just the raw cost of the, are they factored out before that's determined?
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, you know, I really am not the best person to answer that question. Okay. Probably somebody either from the commission or the department might be. My understanding is when we're looking at least cost, we're looking at the cost to the utility or the cost to the ratepayers,
okay.
Which would obviously include whatever subsidies and whatever producer payments, et cetera, would be included in that.
Mr. Chairman, that was a dangerous question for me to ask because I do not know the answer myself, but there's an amendment I have coming in a moment that may help us find that. But I just would like to remind the committee that we used to have some pretty fantastic credits starting, I think, in 1977. And in 1986, what Congress gave, Congress took away and kicked the props out from under a wind industry that was starting to grow at that time. So just a comment, but whenever we get to my amendment, perhaps we can actually address the question.
Yeah, Representative Beard, it would be interesting to sort out this with regard to
yes.
various energy sources,
yes.
including the loan guarantees that we're familiar with another energy source. Any further questions for Ms. Taylor? Seeing none, Mr. Haney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Haney. I'm Legislative and Political Director for the IBEW Minnesota State Council. I come here today to speak in opposition to this bill. Frankly, we see it as a jobs killer. To start with, the renewable energy credit applies to the waste processing facilities, the RDF facilities, where we have somewhere around 250 people employed, the bill could put those facilities at risk. Local 292, the Minneapolis electricians, spent about $250,000 of their own money building out a solar lab at their apprenticeship training facility in St. Michael. Many of you have toured that facility. And there's been 300-400 people that have been through that training to learn how to do solar installations. In addition to that, 343, the Rochester electricians spent somewhere around $100,000 of their money to build out and develop a wind energy training facility for their members, and both facilities have received national acclaim from within the IBEW, but also the respective industries. The jobs that come from installing alternative energy facilities, build-outs, is a growing number. I think in 1994, when the wind mandate was passed, nobody at that time that I've ever run across thought that the wind energy picture would be 15 years later today what it is. It's grown just in a huge way. The reliability, the capacity, the cost efficiency of the units, it's gone way beyond what I think anybody had projected. And I think that American business and ingenuity will do the same with all the other alternative energy venues that are available and will become available as we roll forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haney. Any questions for this witness or for the author? Representative Beard, do you have an amendment?
Mr. Chairman and members, yes, if I can offer the H now. Yeah, I'm going to have to explain this. The H3667A1 amendment, and I think Mr. Eloff is going to read us the how we change the front end of that so it fits this bill, 3582, if I may.
Members, that amendment should be in your packets. I think it originally had a different destination.
Yeah. I decided to pick on Seifert instead of Welkin.
Let's remember the amendment again.
Right here, 3667A1.
The amendment in your packets is coded H3667A1. Mr. Eloff, if you want to inform us as to the alterations in the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 1.1, delete 3667 and insert 3582. Delete line 1.2 and insert, delete everything after the enacting clause and insert, colon. On line 1.3, delete 3 and insert 1. On line 1.7, delete section 216B, point 1692 and insert sections 216B point 1691 and 216B point 682. And the last change that needs to be made to this amendment is to delete line 1.14.
Mr. Chair, that's the amendment. I'll speak to it briefly if you'd like me to.
Representative Beard.
Thank you. You know, I'm in support of what Representative Seifert is trying to do here with revisiting the renewable energy standard. I am concerned that as we've recast the landscape here over the last handful of years, a lot of people have put, with good faith in our intentions here, a lot of money in the ground. And rather than just pell-mell repeal it at this moment, I think, as my line of questioning with Ms. Taylor uncovered, there are some things that we don't know as clearly as we should know. And the intent of this amendment is to actually have the Public Utilities Commission actually develop the report that tells us how much this is actually costing and what the off-ramps mean, what the lowest or the least cost resource actually is. And what I'd like to know is not only the data that they use, but the formula they use, the how they interpret the data to make the cost determination. I think that would be useful for all of us, so we, in some cases, wouldn't be talking past each other, but we could actually talk to the issue at hand as we're trying to determine these policies and whether we need to keep moving ahead with them. One last comment is, where was my note here on that? Oh, the two references that I made were, one was the Renewable Energy Standard, the other is the Mercury standard we passed in 2006. In both cases, speaking only for myself, the assurance that I was given by the regulators, by the environmentalists, and by the utility companies required to comply was that there were enough off-ramps that either if the cost became so prohibitive or if the technology turned out to be not mature or robust enough that the PUC could wave them off and they could continue business as usual until either the technology improved or the cost came down. It turns out, apparently, they have not exercised any of those and don't even, to my understanding, know if and when they ever would. I would like that to be explained also with the mercury reduction plan, which I think in principle is an outstanding plan, but I just want to know exactly how that's impacting our rates, how it's affecting the efficiency of power production, and how it figures into the whole project as well. So that's my amendment. Rather than deal with repealing the entire RES, Mr. Chairman, I'm asking that we delete everything and that we order this study to the Public Utilities Commission, and we can come back here next year and have a seasoned and informed debate about the whole thing.
Representative Baird, just to clarify, I think I neglected to mention, but it clearly was your intent to incorporate into your amendment the changes that
yes,
Mr. Eloff described.
Procedurally, yes, Mr. Chair. Perhaps I should move those, or some, and we can adopt those first if you wish.
You can incorporate.
I will incorporate
them into the amendment, which at that point I don't believe had been offered, but if it had, Representative Beard does offer the amendment as with the incorporations that Mr. Eloff described. Representative Seifert, do you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Franklin and I spoke about this, and I think you referenced this too, that we are in the early stages of this and would like to know what it costs. Now, I have run into people who have said this is going to have a fairly severe impact on ratepayers, on the folks who are consuming electricity. And we've done some initial look at trying to find the research, and I think Representative Beard's amendment does that. Now, I know the makeup of the committee, and I know the mindset of a lot of people on it. I don't think the bill has a very good chance of progressing as it is right now, but I do think that if we want to bring some facts out in relationship to what the cost may be or may not be, I think that would be very helpful for the committee as it convenes next year, as these RES items become more aggressive year after year. I think it's good for this committee to have some good working knowledge of that. So I think Representative Beard's amendment is a pretty thoughtful idea in regard to this. Now, it's up to the committee members on whether they want the information or not. I think it would be something extremely helpful as we move forward to make sure, you know, maybe that's not the case. Maybe there aren't impacts on the ratepayers. We've got a lot of people who believe that it is. But in knowing the makeup of the committee, I think there's a lot of people in the room that would like to know if there, in fact, are some unbiased ways of getting the research on this. And so I'll leave it up to the committee on if they would like to adopt the Beard Amendment or not. I certainly think it's better than not having anything at all.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Representative Beard. When we're looking for facts and trying to get good information, I think getting good information is really important. And I think, unfortunately, with a lot of issues this committee covers, we don't get a lot of it, or it gets obscured, or it gets paid for and promoted in different ways that change the dialogue. And I'm just curious what you mean with impacts on ratepayers, because when I think of a ratepayer, I don't I want to think of someone more than someone paying electric utility, someone with a kid with asthma, perhaps, or someone who likes to go fishing and is concerned about the mercury in their fish. You know, all of these externalities of our electric system that don't get counted just from the perspective of the ratepayer. And the people of Minnesota, they're ratepayers. They're taxpayers, they're parents, they're nurses, they're teachers. And to think of them only as people paying electric utilities, I think, is not the most helpful way to think of our energy policy. And so I'm curious, when you say impact, is it simply costs, or would you be open to looking at other positive impacts of this, you know, whether it's cost reductions or improved health of the people of Minnesota, and also looking at the impact of our other electric choices on Minnesotans broadly, not simply ratepayers.
Mm-hmm. Representative Beard, before you respond, I think that this line of questioning kind of opens up something that I was going to mention at some point, which is that I believe I'm correct in pointing out that the language of the amendment was actually the language of House File 3546, which you did introduce as a bill.
Yes, I think it did.
I think quite appropriately.
Sure.
And I certainly, I think that this is, as everyone seems to be acknowledging, is certainly a matter that deserves discussion. And I would have been happy to hear the bill, except that the author did not request a hearing for the bill. I would be willing to work with you still to enable the bill to be heard, which I think would be much more appropriate than to offer something that clearly does have bill status and importance and ought to be heard out much more thoroughly than we can do as an amendment to another important bill. But I just wanted to throw that out in case you might be interested in pursuing that route.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was formulating a response to Representative Knuth's brilliant question. It was a great setup. Now you've deflected my attention a little bit here, and I'm thinking whether we want to defer that to a hearing after deadlines, because I'm more interested in engaging at this moment in the broader policy implications of what this means. But if I may, just let me respond briefly. And then let's contemplate whether we want to withdraw the amendment and vote up or down on this bill and come back with a little more discussion, because I can see some people in the audience I'd love to have sitting up here talking about the ramifications of what this means and what we would like to see the study include.
Well, in fairness, Representative Beard, I think that there would be a lot of people that want
sure.
to discuss the ramifications, and we're not giving them a chance to do that on the fly here.
Yeah, not in the next 43 minutes, we're not, are we?
But right.
Can I still have the floor before Magnus jumps in front of me, Mr. Chair?
I still have the gavel, Representative.
You do. You do, yes. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Knuth, thank you for the great question, because this is something I remember. And again, I'm looking around the table, and besides Atkins and I and Magnus, there's not too much gray here without looking that way. We remember this from before, whenever Julius Simon was kicking Paul Ehrlich's butt on the resource depletion thing. And one of the things that Ehrlich did to deflect the whole thing was say, well, you have to bring in the society, you have to societize the cost and bring in the externalities. It's a great argument whenever you're losing the one at the hand. It's just, oh, by the way. In this case, yes, I would welcome that discussion, because if we're going to talk about clean water and fish with little or no mercury in them, as little as we can get, I want to know if we have to go home and eat them right away or whether we can put them in the freezer. That's an important thing to know. If my child has asthma, I want to know if there's a hospital somewhere with reliable, clean power that keeps the lights on and place laboratories that can create vaccines or inhalers and pack those things, and that they can take advantage of the power that we have, and whether we're going to roll in those externalities as well as a perceived increase in asthma. And I don't know if the PUC is up to that task, but they certainly are up to the task of talking about what is the least cost resource when it comes to just keeping 110 or 220 volts of power in these cords and how much they charge us when it passes the meter. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll withhold the rest of my comments, because this does sound like it's probably a committee bill. and or a bill that should stand on its own, and we should have a great discussion about.
I'd certainly be willing to do everything I can to facilitate that, Representative Beard.
Okay. And I have about six other bills that I've asked for. That's the reason I haven't asked for this one. So it's out there, but nothing personal.
Representative Beard, I believe there's a way that we could do this without coming into conflict with deadlines, and I'll be happy to talk to you about that after the
okay. hearing. Well, with that, Mr. Chairman, and with the indulgence of the committee, and I hope you don't perceive I'm wasting your time because I think the discussion is valuable, I will withdraw my amendment and we'll let the bill stand on its particular merits and go from there.
With that, is there further discussion to the bill? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would request a roll call on this bill.
Roll call having been requested, seeing no further discussion, Mr. the clerk will take the roll.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative.
Mr. Chair, where was this going again?
To rules.
Oh, to rules.
Yes.
Okay.
There was no Senate companion meeting to the deadline. We're hearing this after.
So Mr. Chair, rules might be too busy to take it up. Is what you what you're telling me?
You never know, Representative West. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Falk?
No.
Westrom?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Atkins?
No.
Beard?
Aye.
Bly?
No.
Reinert?
No.
Gunther?
Aye.
Hackbar?
Aye.
Poppy? Portman?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Kalin?
No.
Knuth?
No.
Kulik Jackson?
No.
Magnus?
Yes.
Nornis?
Yes.
Obermuller?
No.
Purcell?
No.
Sailor.
One of the more convincing no's.
This is a very guttural no, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't even use a microphone.
Seifert.
Yes.
Welty.
No.
There being 8 ayes and 14 nays, the motion does not prevail. The bill is not passed. Representative Welty, House File 3429. Representative Western.
Just while Mr. Representative Welty is coming up there. Seeing we've got about 4 bills left, is there what's your plan if we don't finish by the end of committee?
Representative Westrom, I announced at the beginning of the committee that if we did not finish the agenda today, we would take up the remaining items at 10:30 a.m. on Friday.
All right. Okay.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3429 is before you, and I move that it pass and be referred to the General Register.
That motion is before us, Representative Welty.
Mr. Chair.
All right. And Mr. Chair and members, I would appreciate if we could move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form that we want that at the time.
Representative Welty, could you pull the mic closer to you?
Sure.
There you go.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the 3429 DE1 amendment at this time to get the bill in the form for discussion.
The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Welty, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill came before me at the request of People's Cooperative and Dairyland Power in southeastern Minnesota. There is the potential to develop a wind farm, or excuse me, not a wind farm, but a solar farm on an abandoned landfill site. And with me today to give you more of a description of this project is Kenrick Scavel, and he is here on behalf of Dairyland Power. But quickly, I just want to describe what this bill actually does to members. What the cooperative is looking to do is to be able to count the energy and the conservation related to the solar project in the SIP goal. So we're not talking about the SIP dollars being used, we're talking about the SIP goal and allowing the conservation to be counted towards that. So this would be the first of its kind type of project of this size. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Kenrick Scavel to discuss this a little bit further.
Former Senator Scavel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kenrick Scavel. I work for Dairyland Power Cooperative, generation and transmission co-op headquartered in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We provide wholesale electricity and services to 25 distribution cooperatives, 19 municipalities in 4 Midwestern states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. The 3 cooperatives we serve in Minnesota are respectively located in Rushford, in Rochester, and in Elbert Lee. I'm here today asking for your help in making the Upper Midwest's largest solar farm a reality. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is pursuing better ways of utilizing closed landfill sites by using them as host sites for renewable energy generation. More specifically, MPCA would like to demonstrate the feasibility of building a solar array on the site of an existing closed landfill. The site that they have identified for the project is a site just north of Rochester off Highway 52 near Orinoco, and they have also chosen Westwood Renewables as the program managers to build between a 1 to 5 megawatt solar array on this closed landfill site. The site is in the service territory of People's Cooperative Services, and they are also here today in case there are questions for them. Dairyland has been approached by Westwood Renewables about participating in this project through entering into a long-term power purchase agreement. Dairyland and Peoples are enthusiastic about this project, which we feel would be a good addition to our already diverse renewable energy portfolio. This would make a wonderful photovoltaic solar demonstration project with national, state, and local partnerships. Photovoltaic solar projects present daunting financial challenges. Finding a rate that cash flows for the project and yet is competitive to other renewable technologies. Dairyland has a board adopted renewable energy tariff in place that is competitive in the industry but falls short of meeting the revenue stream needed to cash flow this project. We are looking for opportunities to enhance the value of this project in order to justify paying a price in excess of our current distributed generation tariff for the energy from this project. In other words, we're looking for ways to bridge the funding gap on this project. The policy, What we are proposing is to allow Dairyland to claim conservation improvement credits for the energy produced by this specific demonstration project. In the same way renewable projects currently generate green tags, which can be used to meet the state's renewable energy standard, we are proposing that this project would generate what I'll refer to as white tags, which can be used to assist our distribution cooperatives meet the state's 1.5% energy efficiency standard. The policy basis from which I base this this bill is statutes 216B.2411. Current law provides that utilities may invest up to 5% of their SIP spending on renewable energy projects, including solar projects up to 100 kW. Such projects must be counted as energy conservation improvements and may also be counted toward the renewable energy objectives. We are not seeking to use SIP dollars to fund the solar project. Only to allow us to count the generation from this project toward meeting a portion of our 1.5% energy efficiency standard. So what we're requesting are two variances to current law. A, raise the threshold for the solar project from 100 kW to 2 megawatts, so it's a larger project, and B, allow the energy produced to count toward the full 1.5% SIP standard. Again, we're not requesting an overall policy change to current statutes, but only for this as a specific demonstration project. The ability to claim, again, the term white tags for this project should provide Darylin sufficient added value to enable us to bridge the funding gap between our current tariff and what the developer needs to make the project cash flow. Your support of this legislation can help make this project a reality.
Any questions for Mr. Scavel or the author? Seeing none. Representative Walton, Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I think I had an amendment to offer to 3429 regarding the problem we have with our friends in North Dakota on purchase power purchase agreements. This be a good place to discuss this, or would you rather we brought this one back as a bill hearing also, since I have a couple related to that? Before we get into the whole thing, let's just talk that over. That'd be the A1 amendment.
Representative Beard, I think that's, if you want to offer the amendment, it's your prerogative.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually offering one that just lifts the restriction on purchase power agreements for our power companies in the state that buy a lot of power from North Dakota in particular. I do have a bill that actually does this and addresses the price per ton of carbon dioxide that we've ordered the PUC to deal with. I'd rather actually hear that one and offer this one as an amendment. So I'd like to offer the A1 amendment and speak to it briefly. I think it's in our packets.
Representative Beard does offer the A1 amendment. Representative Beard.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I think one of the things that kind of slipped by us in one of those Senate files we voted on a few years ago was that if the Midwest Governor's Greenhouse Gas Accord Group, working group, I think actually is the entire lengthy name of that project, did not reach an agreement and bring us something by August 1st of 2009, a date which has come and gone, without that agreement or without even a proposal, that we then kind of hobbled ourselves here with the prohibition on building any new coal-fired facility in the state, and beyond that, prohibiting our electric companies from entering into purchase power agreements of more than 50 megawatts from any coal-fired facility outside of the state, regardless of where it comes from. I think that we are inadvertently put ourselves in a box there and probably violated something to do with an interstate commerce clause in the Constitution. A simple remedy to that would be to adopt my amendment, and I think we fixed a couple problems in one shot. So with that, I'd move its adoption, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion to the amendment? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Beard, I understand the point you're trying to make and the issue that you want to address, but I believe this would greatly increase the scope of the bill that we have here in front of us, which is a solar project, and we're talking about SIP credits. So, members, I would appreciate it if you would vote no on this, or Representative Beard, if you'd withdraw this so that we could just have a clean bill moving out of here.
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with thanks to Dairyland Cooperative, we'd appreciate their support in helping to lift it, because I'm sure they're going to benefit as well. But perhaps I can ready to move to a voice vote. But thank you for your request.
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'll request a roll call. Okay.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Beard.
Yes.
I did see the opportunity presented by these amendments to kind of review the legislation that we have been referring to here. Mm-hmm. And there is a provision, one of the off-ramps, mm-hmm. that is described in the bill. And it's
under subdivision 7, and I find somewhere here, I have a different, I had printed a different version. It's 216H.02, exemptions. Among them is a new large energy facility or power purchase agreement between a Minnesota utility and a new large energy facility located outside Minnesota that the public that the Public Utilities Commission has determined is essential to ensure the long-term reliability of Minnesota's electric system. That was a specific exemption for Big Stone 2.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm aware, we have not heard, with the exception of the question about the Great River Energy's project at Spiritwood, which they did not mention at the time that this went together.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We have not really heard any utility tell us that they had a need for additional coal-fired resource from anywhere, which kind of calls into question mm-hmm. why we would want to remove this exemption at this time, particularly since I believe your amendment would do the reverse of what North Dakota is claiming and actually put Minnesota at a disadvantage, since you're proposing to allow power to be imported from any state except Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, I have a bill that deals with that too. But that's
well, Representative Beard, you know.
But I wasn't going to offer that as an amendment
through
today.
Our files, and I discovered that
yes.
we didn't have a hearing request on any of those bills, Representative Beard.
Not yet, Mr. Chairman. if you'd like, this actually I'm offering on behalf of, Representative Olin offered to carry this bill with the just lifting the purchase power agreements. I'm looking, though, to see if I could have the Office of Energy Security speak about the issue you just raised, about who's dealing with power and so on. If you'd like to do that, I'm willing to ask for that testimony.
Representative Beard, I should point out, since, as you mentioned, this is clearly about the current issue with North Dakota.
Yes.
Representative Westrom and I did meet with mm-hmm. a delegation from North Dakota that included the governor's chief of staff and the attorney general.
Yes.
And I think we both committed to work with them to find a solution that was perhaps a little less severe than the one that's currently proposed.
Well, thank you for the offer and the off-ramp I think I'm sensing, but Mr. Chairman, I'm going to stick with the amendment. We can vote it up or down, and I thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chairman,
unless you have testimony.
We can entertain testimony if you wish to call someone down, Representative Beard.
Mr.
I don't know how you're feeling about Friday.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Friday, and I'm thinking about an important bill. Another important bill or two we need to hear. So I'm going to decline the testimony, and I'm prepared to hear the vote. And we'll keep discussing this.
Representative Purcell,
are we back to the bill yet?
Yes.
The amendment.
No, we're on the amendment,
okay.
Representative Purcell. And I believe a roll call has been requested. Representative Weston.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my question might be, what do you have any idea of other bills or opportunities we might have? And certainly we haven't had the vote yet, so maybe this will go on and that'll create the opportunity for some more discussion. If it doesn't go on, what other options would we potentially have? Have you had a chance to think through any ideas? And as I understood our meeting and that we had, essentially if the issue isn't brought up or resolved this session, we're probably going to be sitting in a position where there's a lawsuit to bring this matter to closure, and then we kind of missed the window of opportunity. So
Just if you could give me thoughts on any other thoughts you've had or insights and where maybe we could take this issue up if it doesn't pass.
Well, Representative Westrom, I think this is a matter that rises to a sufficient level of concern that if we can work something out with the representatives from North Dakota with whom we spoke, we'll find a way to deal with it. Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no. We're voting on the Beard Amendment, yes. Members.
Falk?
No.
Westrom?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Atkins?
No.
Beard?
Aye.
Bly?
No.
Reinert?
No.
Gunther?
No.
Hackbarth?
Aye.
Hoppy? Portman?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Kalen?
No.
Knuth?
No.
Kulik Jackson?
No.
Magnus?
Aye.
Nornis?
Aye.
Obermueller?
No.
Purcell?
No.
Saylor?
No.
Seifert?
Aye.
Oh. Welty?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 15 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Back to the bill. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I do want to offer one minor amendment, and that would be on line 1.8, where it has the number 2. I'd like to change that to 5, because there is the potential at this point in time that the solar farm could be up to 5 megawatts. And if members have a concern about that, we won't move it. But if everybody would agree to that, then we have moved that forward at this time.
Mr. Eloff, do you have the amendment? And would you reiterate that for the committee, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, on line one.
Welty, I'm going to have Mr. Eloff do that.
Okay.
Mr. Eloff.
Line 1.8, delete the word 2 and insert 5.
Representative Kalen.
This is to the larger bill as amended by the DE1 amendment.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Welty, the reason for going to 5?
Representative Welty or Mr. Scalo?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I could respond to that. The project, as it's going to be developed, will be originally sized somewhere in the 1 to 2 megawatt scale. The site is large enough that in the future it could be expanded up to 5 megawatts. So the question I'm putting, Representative Welty is putting to the committee, do you want to incent up to 5 megawatts of solar on this project or limit it to 2? From Darrell's perspective, we prefer more flexibility, but that's up to the committee, will of the committee.
Further discussion to the amendment? Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I missed this, but just out of curiosity, will the energy generated also count towards the RES that you have to meet as well? So it's kind of double dipping the for you using SIP dollars and then to meet the RES. Or I'm sorry if I didn't catch that,
Mr. Scale.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the project will not use any SIP dollars for funding. What we are asking is that in addition to claiming the green tags to meet the RES, we would also be able to claim energy efficiency tags to aid our cooperatives in meeting the 1.5%
energy efficiency standard. But there will be no diversion of energy efficiency efforts or dollars toward those energy efficiency efforts.
Further discussion to the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Scavel, when we reformed the SIP a couple years ago, didn't we essentially do away with the dollars and just met benchmarks that each year you have to achieve as a utility, or how does that square? And I've been a long-time proponent to allow SIP dollars to account towards these projects. So, but is there actually SIP dollars that you guys could use for this in addition, or is it just that you've got to meet your threshold of 1.5%?
Mr. Chair, as I understand the law, there is still a minimum requirement of SIP expenditures, but in addition, there is a outcomes-based standard now that you have to meet a 1.5% annual energy efficiency effort or standard. Since Barreland is not investing in this project, we're purchasing the output via power purchase agreement. There's really no need for us to divert SIP dollars away from incentives like CFLs, energy efficiency appliances, etc. So we see no reason to divert them. And for comfort of the legislative body, we have specifically chosen not to.
Further discussion? Representative Kalen.
Mr. Chair, this is to this point, but not necessarily to the 2-5 amendment. So I'd like to vote on that amendment, but would not to not lose the point.
There being no further discussion to the amendment, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kalen.
Thank you, Mr.
Bill,
Chair. Sorry. This notion of being able to get RES credit as well as then the KWH savings credit. We're in this transition to the results oriented, to having to show kilowatt hours and BTUs, and as the author of the bill that brought co-ops into that world, I know that you are all working extremely hard to meet that standard. My concern is that the goal is really a true kilowatt hours goal, and so by meeting that goal through this large project that I think is a valid and important project, and I like the idea, and I have been aware of similar proposals, will actually divert attention from other energy savings projects within the service territory, because you will be meeting that goal with generation, not with efficiency efforts. And so I have great pause about that we really are going to be diverting effort, not necessarily, I mean, we will be diverting dollars. You're not applying the overlapping dollar spending requirement to this project, but I'm just grown more concerned about counting for the first time large megawatts as efficiency, as opposed to smaller distributed savings that stay usually inside the meter and in that, you know, essentially slow the spin of the meter, which has been the goal of SIP.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I understand those concerns. Keep in mind that a solar project of, say, 2 megawatts sounds large, but when you factor in that it's probably a 15-16% capacity factor, the number of megawatt hours generated really isn't that large. At a 1 megawatt project, which is kind of what we're expecting as a minimum, 2 megawatts maximum, 1 megawatt would provide enough kilowatt hours of generation to assist our cooperatives with about 10% of their goal. other words, it certainly doesn't remove from them the challenge of meeting a 1.5%. It assists them, but it certainly doesn't do it for them.
Mr. Chair, then if, understanding that the, I think the move from 2 to 5 makes sense in terms of flexibility that we just did, but let's say that you achieve the full maximum potential that we would be giving you, so 5 megawatts, am I to understand that, that you might be meeting 50% of your goal for SIP through this project?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that would be correct if it were to develop fully to 5 megawatts and our system didn't grow. That would be based on today's growth.
Well, I think that I'm more troubled by it now, Mr. Chair, because I think that the you know, the basic tenet of energy efficiency in the SIP program has been that it's been the lowest cost way of keeping the lights on and keeping things reliable, and this starts to dramatically change that. And so I guess I'm quite concerned about the proposal as we have it. I think the project is a worthy project, and finding ways to make the P&L work for this project makes sense, but I don't think that this is the right approach to do it.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to members, you know, Representative Kalin, I understand that you were kind of the champion behind the conservation legislation and moving that forward, and I respect the work that you have done in that area, and I know that you want to truly keep it with conservation, but I believe that, you know, we can meet a couple of goals here. First of all, moving more down the road of the renewables and looking at a solar and a solar farm of this size would be the first in the state. And not only that, but we do achieve some conservation through this and line loss and some other issues that I've heard about. I just believe that this concept is a very good concept, that the incentive, if the local cooperative needs a little bit more of an incentive to make this become a reality, I think that this is not going too far as state policy is concerned, and it is this one project.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, Representative Welty, could you characterize the 1.9 there is talking about this is going to be located on the site of a closed landfill owned by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. How does that work contractually? Are you leasing that property, or I'm just curious as to how that works.
Mr. Scable.
Mr. Chair, I can attempt to respond to that. We do have the program manager here that has been involved in those discussions directly with MPCA. If the representative would like that, I suspect Nathan would be able to give a more concise answer than perhaps I can.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to take that offline and get ahead with it.
Further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Welty renews his motion that House File 3429, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Oh.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed. before we adjourn for today, members, we do have the minutes from March 10th before us. Chair would entertain a motion for their adoption.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor.